Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
How's it going?
Things are good. Feeling pretty upbeat. Weather's nice. Life is nice. I'm just kind of enjoying these moments when we're in flow. In a good way. How about you? What inspires you these days?
Well, just before we before we went on the air, I told you about a vacation that I've got coming up in August. It's still a ways off, but that inspires me to continue on living.
And, exactly.
I always need something to look forward to, and it's usually a vacation or some time off or plans or something like that. So I'm inspired by my work. I've worked here 30 years, and I guess I must like it at some level. So
it doesn't get boring.
It never, almost never gets boring because I wear so many hats that I do this in the morning, then I go do this, and then I go on the air in the afternoon, then I do your show on Tuesdays. So it's always something different.
And I think those are, you hit on two key things. One is novelty, that we all need novelty in our life to help us stay inspired, to help us stay connected or interested. It's interesting how quickly ruts kind of show up in our life, that it feels good to get comfortable and have a daily routine, but then before you know it, you're kind of just stuck in that cushion in your couch. And so by having things that are novel and new and different week after week help keep us kind of moving forward. And then this idea of having something to look forward to, right? A reason to get up in the morning, something that gets us out of bed, something down the road. Those pieces of inspiration are really important because, remember, as I mentioned last week, my theme this year is about inspiration. We spent last year in kind of a dark space and spend a lot of time talking about really heavy topics. And it doesn't mean we won't cover heavy topics again this year, but I also want to make sure that we intersperse enough hope and inspiration that we all can feel a little lighter in our step, that we can take a moment and look around and see the good things that are going on as well as the tough things. So
I like that.
I like that too. I mean, I like to have like a power theme for 2018, and it's all about inspiration moving forward. So having said that,
where are we off to today?
Well, I am really excited about today because we have a guest in the studio, and I love when things just kind of all fall together easily. I was contacted by Elisa through Transitions Mental Health, which is an agency here in San Luis Obispo. And every year for the last 9 years, they put together a program called the Journey of Hope. And it has a theme about mental health and issues that kind of many, many people will relate to. And they put on a community-wide event. It's open, free to the community. Anyone can come. And it's happening this Wednesday, tomorrow night, January the 24th. And the theme, the Journey of Hope theme this year was about resiliency and recovery. It's a community forum on living mentally well. And when Elisa sent me the information, she showed me, or on there was the keynote speaker, and the keynote speaker, Jennifer Storm's story, just totally grabbed me. Just all of the things that I love about ordinary people who do extraordinary things. She is an author. She was appointed a victim advocate for the state of Pennsylvania by the governor. She has turned her life around and become an inspiration to people all over the world. She has a TED Talk that she can listen to. She comes to her work and to her keynote speaking with just a lot of genuine honesty about what it is to live through trauma and addiction and loss and adversity and come out stronger and healthier down the road. So I contacted Elisa and said, I would love to have Jennifer Storm come in and talk to me if possible. And they said, no problem, but her plane lands at 12:45 on Tuesday. Is that going to be a problem? And I said, I'm going to trust the weather gods that San Luis Obispo Airport will be our friend and that everything will work out. And sure enough, Jennifer Storm's here in the studio with us today. So I'm excited to hear her story and hear from her about how we can take components of our own life and our own recovery and utilize them to maintain good mental health. So that's our story today. So If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'll be opening up the phone lines in a bit. Our number is 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And you can also be part of the show by visiting our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can like the page and get updates every week on the shows that we'll be presenting. You can leave messages there. You can start a conversation. I need to be better about posting pictures and follow-ups to shows because I have some really great photos that need to go up on the Facebook page, so make sure you check it out. You can podcast our show by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR One. Search A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and the show will be uploaded to your device. And you can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. I'm always happy to respond to any questions and concerns as best I can. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jennifer Storm. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me.
So I'm going to, there's a lot of different introductions that I read about you. So I'm going to use a couple. Jennifer Storm is an author, appointed victim advocate by the governor of Pennsylvania. Jennifer is also a survivor turned thriver who overcame addiction, trauma, adversity, and now shares her story of recovery with others. Jennifer has written two books, correct? Three books.
Yes.
But her book, Blackout Girl, Growing Up and Drying Out in America, was her memoir that documents her journey to becoming a victim advocate. As I mentioned earlier, she has a TED Talk that she gave at Muncie State Prison, which I'm interested to find out how that came around. And she speaks about resiliency and recovery. And so I'm sure this is not a short journey that we're talking about.
No.
But you will be the keynote speaker tomorrow night for Transitions Mental Health Community Forum on Living Mentally Well. So, Jennifer, tell me how you got to where you are today. I mean, that's so broad, but but tell me your life story.
Sure. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, was born and raised in kind of the Lehigh Valley area. So Easton, Bethlehem, you think of Billy Joel, you know, the Easton, Bethlehem, Allentown area. And had two parents who were very loving, had two older brothers. Both my parents struggled. They both came from very abusive alcoholic homes. And so the majority of my family was addicted in one way or another. And so, but my parents kind of found each other in Jersey. They met in New Jersey and fell in love in Phillipsburg at Phillipsburg High School and kind of got together very early on. So they were each other's first loves. And then, you know, my dad went off to Vietnam, kind of came back with a whole host of PTSD and all sorts of other issues. And then they started having children. And so, you know, my dad kind of put down the hippie gear and picked up a suitcase and got a job. And, you know, for the first 10, 12 years of my life, life was normal. We moved a lot. There was definitely some instability in that sense. And I think that was my father just kind of moving through his different career tracks. Mm-hmm. So we would flux into different socioeconomic statuses. We'd go from a trailer to a mansion to a trailer to a townhome.
And all over Pennsylvania?
All over Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Once in Tennessee. The mansion was in Franklin, Tennessee. Randomly, my father just kind of put us all in a car and said, we're moving to Tennessee. And he had a business opportunity and didn't go super well. So within a year, we came back. But it was a beautiful gated community in Franklin, Tennessee. I actually really loved it there. So definitely a lot of inconsistency. So I learned really early on to be a chameleon, you know, to fit in. When you're in and out of different schools and you don't really have a stable kind of friend base,
right.
You really learn what people expect of you quickly, and then you learn how to blend.
And how about with two older brothers?
They were, yeah, they. I was the only girl, so that was challenging. And of course, I was also the youngest, so I was the, you know, the wrestling dummy. I was the one that got taunted and teased a lot. I was super close with my brother, who's only a year and a half older than I am. And a lot of people actually thought we were twins. We look very, very similar. If I cut my hair, I look like him. If he grows his, he looks like me. And then my oldest brother, who's 4 years older than I am, we were close intermittently. So when I was super young, we weren't really close. And then when I kind of went through some struggles in my teen years, we were close. But I had a good life. You know, I mean, my family, the one thing I will say about my parents, regardless of what was going on in their worlds, they really provided for us. Mm-hmm. My mom always had depression. And she, when I was born, and I kind of came very unexpectedly, I was born in the bed that I was brewed in, I often say, and just kind of happened really quickly one evening before the ambulance could get there. I had kind of arrived.
The original home birth experience.
Yes, yes. And my brother watched the whole thing. So he definitely, I'm sure, was traumatized by that, being 4 years old and kind of seeing that. And my aunt delivered me. And my mom really struggled after that. I was separated from her for a period of time. So there wasn't that kind of immediate mother-daughter connection. Mm-hmm. And I often look back on that and it kind of makes sense moving forward as our relationship did. And so then my mother was prescribed Valium. And so up to that point, you know, my parents drank. They smoked a lot of pot. You know, it was just from their generation. But they never did that in front of us. I mean, they would drink in front of us, but our home was not an alcoholic home, and our home was not riddled with parties. But my mother started taking Valium on a daily basis, and it was a result of her nerves and the trauma she endured with my birth. And that was kind of a fact that she never let me forget as I started to kind of get older and understand.
That was the story of Jennifer.
It was. It
was. She,
like,
was a trauma from birth.
Yeah, that I traumatized my mother. Yeah. And, you know, and she took these little pink, these little yellow pills as a result of that. And she was a housewife, so she stayed home. My father worked. My grandmother, who was my mom's mom, who I just adored, would live with us on and off. And she was a hardcore alcoholic. And after one night of...
Do you remember being aware of that as a young kid, or was
no.
it, this is just my family?
No, it's just my grandmother's really funny.
Okay.
Like, I knew I loved my grandmother, and it was because she always made me laugh, and she was always happy. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was because she was always drunk.
Right.
You know, it was just like she was the funny Irish lady in the house.
So everyone's coping mechanisms weren't apparent. It was just kind of there underneath the whole family dynamic.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. She ended up moving to Tennessee with us. So that was when I was nine. Between ages 8 and 9, we moved to Tennessee. And that's when my mom's depression got really bad. So it became apparent. You know, I'd find her in places in the home just sobbing uncontrollably, and I would try to comfort her. And my mom was not a big fan of mine. It's kind of the best way that I can put it. Mm-hmm. I think that she saw me as competition. She very much liked being the apple of my father's eye. And when I came, I then became that, and I kind of took that role from her. So she wasn't very nurturing or loving to me. I mean, there's stories of me being locked out of the house and, you know, just not great things, and her not being very kind to me. I wasn't really aware of that, obviously, at a young age. But I always knew my mom just wasn't happy. And I wanted to make her happy. That was like this driving desire that I had. So when we moved back to Pennsylvania, she and my father, just you could tell their marriage was really struggling. And I always knew my father wasn't happy. Now my brothers would tell you a different story because that's how that works. You grow up in one house. We all have different perspectives.
Exactly.
But I could see, you know, my father did everything. My mom didn't have a license, so my father drove. When we moved back to Pennsylvania, both of my brothers were wrestlers. They were football players. And we all did well in school. Like, I had perfect attendance, straight A's. Like, I was kind of a nerd. Mm-hmm. You know, I just really – I wanted to achieve, and I loved reading. I would get lost for hours and hours in books. And when I look back on it, I've said many times that I think reading was my first escape, because I could just kind of bore myself into those pages, and it was no longer my life. It was about the pages on the book and the stories. And but for the most part, I was happy. It was a good life. All of that changed one day in 1987 when I was raped by an individual who was 28 years old. I was 12 at this time. So we had moved back from Tennessee. We had lived briefly in a townhome, and I had gone to one school, and then we moved to this trailer park in Moore Township, and then I went to another school. And that's when roller skating was really big, right? It was the 80s. Everyone was on roller skates. And I started going roller skating, and I started hanging out with this older crowd, and there was this one girl who was 16 who kind of, you know, became my best friend. And, you know, one night she said, well, why don't we go roller skating? I can come pick you up. My boyfriend has a license. He can come pick us up. So, of course, you know, I begged my parents. And at first my mom was like, no, no. And then my dad said, oh, if you can get your mom to agree. It was that whole play the parents against each other. And they let me go. And, you know, this was in the 80s. So it wasn't like we had stranger danger talks. And there wasn't that heightened awareness of child sex abuse. And there just wasn't. And so I walked to the front of our – trailer park without, you know, anybody with me. And then I got into this car. And when I got in, I realized, like, oh, there's, like, this guy's, like, much older than I am. But I didn't really think much of it. I thought, okay, we're just going to go roller skating. And then there was another guy in the car. And then there was a big cooler. And so we went to a quarry. If you're from that area, you know, quarries are
big
and that's usually where people hang out and party. And before I knew it, someone was handing me this 16-ounce beer. And, you know, prior to that, I had had maybe a couple sips of alcohol. Like, my mom would drink these cream de menthe drinks. Mm-hmm. And I loved the color because it was the same color of my bedroom walls. So I would drink those. And I liked the, like, tingling that I would get on my tongue. But I'd never – you know, I was 12. I never had a drink. Until then. And I drank and I drank and I drank. And I write in the book that I never remember being that thirsty before. I remember giggling a lot. I remember urinating outside for the first time with my friend and us kind of falling over each other and just laughing. And then everything went black. I don't remember anything. There was still daylight at that point. And then the next thing I knew, I woke up and it was pitch black and there was this man on top of me raping me. Pushed him off me, and I remember seeing lights. It was very dark, as most rural Pennsylvania places are. They're very dark. And I remember just running towards the light, and it was the vehicle that I had come in. I jumped in the car, and I was trying to get away, and I remember jiggling the stick shift. I didn't know what I was doing. And then I remember my friend running towards me screaming, and then everything went black. And then my next memory is literally me leaning out onto a highway, just vomiting all over a highway. And then my next memory is being at a bowling alley. And, you know, my friend's kind of dragging me into the bathroom. And all I know is she's really mad at me. And I don't know why. And I'm a mess. You know, I'm just a total mess. And I'm scared. And I'm starting to kind of sober up. I had all these red marks on my neck. I didn't know what they were. And I was just really confused. I just kept telling her, I just want to go home. And she was scared, and I didn't know why. And she's just like, well, we can't take you home. We're just going to go back to my boyfriend's house, and we're going to figure out what to do. And so we went back to his house. And I remember laying there on a floor, and she was in a bed with her boyfriend. And this man who had just assaulted me is, like, laying there with me. And I remember just feeling like I was going to come out of my skin. And I'm still pretty intoxicated at this point, clearly.
And you're 12.
And I'm 12. You know, I'm a child. So I had said that I needed to go to the bathroom. And the guy was like, oh, okay, it's show me where it was. And so I found a phone and I called my house. I just remember hearing my mother's voice and saying, you know, where are you? Where are you? And I just said, I don't know, but I need to come home. And she had said, well, the police are here. You need to come home. So it must have been, I think at this point it was like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So I went back into the bedroom and I said, listen, I just called my parents and the cops are there and you have to take me home right now. And so they did, thankfully. And I remember the last thing that my friend said, and I'm using air quotes, was, you know, please don't tell anybody what happened. You know, I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want them to get in trouble. Don't tell anyone what happened. And I just kind of looked at her, and I think the last thing I said, I just looked at her and said, I thought we were going roller skating. Like, I was so confused. And I walked back into my home, and, you know, I was a different person. My mom immediately came up to me and saw me and saw how disheveled I was, and I'm assuming I stunk like a brewery, and she just hauled off and smacked me. And I just started to sob. You know, I didn't know there was cops, and my dad was standing there. And so she took me into the bathroom and started to disrobe me, and then realized, you know, I had bruises and I was bleeding. And then she came out and said, you know, I think she was raped. So I had to go to the hospital and have a rape exam done. And I didn't have a victim advocate there. This was 1987.
Did they exist?
They did. They were just – the rape crisis movement was kind of just starting to surface. And so – but it wasn't to the organized effect that it is today, where if you go to the hospital for a rape exam, there is usually – should be always a rape advocate there that's called to the scene that helps you through that. You know, so it was just my mom and I had this doctor who looked like Tony Orlando, which I know I'm dating myself with that. It's all I can remember. And then I went through this second violation that I didn't understand. I didn't realize that my body was a crime scene. And, you know, they pluck your hair and they scrape your fingernails and they insert things in places and they're scraping you everywhere because you're evidence.
And right? You still haven't had a shower.
No. And I'm watching my clothes. My favorite, like, Swatch rugby shirt is getting bagged into this brown bag with evidence tape. And nobody's explaining this. No one's telling us what's happening. And then I just had to go home. And it was Easter morning, actually. which, you know, I was supposed to be in church singing in the choir, and here I was having this experience. And so then I remember coming back into my house, and I remember seeing my father cry for the first time, which destroyed me. And then I remember seeing my brothers cry, and all I kept thinking was, oh my God, what did I do? Right? This immediate insurgence of shame and guilt just consumed me. And I thought, I am this dirty, horrible person. And I couldn't understand why. And I didn't really understand what had happened to me. I just knew that I had broken my family.
Right.
And I felt broken. I was not the same girl that walked out of the house hours prior with the roller skates. Yeah, it was just, it was like everything I once knew about myself and my life was gone.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Jennifer Storm. She's an author and appointed victim advocate by the governor of Pennsylvania, and she's coming to town to talk at the Transitions Mental Health Community Forum on Living Mentally Well, Journey of Hope, tomorrow night, January 24th. And we're talking about Jennifer's experience, what led her into addiction following this trauma, and then eventually into recovery and to this position of inspiration and hope for others. You're listening to public radio KCBX. And so at this moment, you're 12 years old. You all of a sudden now, it has nothing to do with you being cared for. It's you now feeling like you've hurt everyone else.
Yeah.
What happened from this point forward then at 12?
I couldn't sleep. I had insomnia. I didn't realize at this point that I had PTSD, because that wasn't even a term that we even used. I mean, we maybe used it for Vietnam vets, but that was it. So I had hypervigilance. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't stand being in my own skin. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror because I hated what I saw. So I began hurting myself. I started cutting. I would get these just enraged, and I would have to release that in some way. So I would hit things. So hitting and cutting were two things that I just, for whatever reason, I just kind of intuitively thought, oh, if I hurt myself, I'll feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before we even had the term cutting. You know, it was like a known thing. And that didn't really work super well. So then I started drinking.
And there was no counseling for you post this experience, right?
There,
no follow-up, no victim advocate for you.
No, my family just kind of walked around me like nothing had happened.
Like hoped it would all go away.
Yes, and nobody talked about it. Mm-hmm. It was like this horrible thing that happened, but nobody talked about it. So we were to just kind of continue to act normal, which, you know, I was anything but normal. And so I started drinking, and my parents still had alcohol in the house. My friends had alcohol in their homes. So I was able to kind of, you know, drink and to the point I needed. I liked drinking because it made me forget. And so I didn't have like an immediate cause and effect relationship with alcohol where like, oh, I drank this stuff and then this horrible thing happened. Not saying in any way, shape, or form that the drinking caused the horrible thing, because it did not. It was the pedophile who looked at an opportunity. But I didn't have like a cause and effect negative relationship with alcohol. Mm-hmm. It became the solution. It became what allowed me to escape all the horrible feelings I was feeling. And so when I was 13, I was going to trial. They did arrest him, and I had to testify at the preliminary hearing, which was incredibly uncomfortable. And I had a really hard time. You know, I was able to remember very, very little, just bits and pieces. You know, I had blacked out completely for the majority of it. And what I told you is still to this day what I recall. And so after that, I was just really, really lost. And it was going into the summertime. And prior to leaving school, I had confided in what I thought was my best friend. And then she wrote a note and told the whole school. And at lunch, I saw this note being passed around about what a slut I was and that I had gone and done this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately realized, okay, we don't talk about this. Can't trust anybody. And so
it becomes a secret.
It becomes a secret, yeah. Because nobody – obviously, I was this dirty person that we weren't supposed to talk about. And so, you know, alcohol was the saving grace. So when I was 13, this was only a couple months after the assault, I took my mother's Valium. She had a bottle of Valium there. At that time, my grandmother was living with us, and I took a bottle of her blood pressure pills, and I washed them down with a bottle of peach schnapps. And it was my first kind of suicide attempt slash like somebody noticed me.
Yes,
come in
cry
pain.
For help.
Cry for help. Yeah. So that resulted in me going into a treatment facility for the entire summer leading up to seventh grade. It did nothing for me. They weren't trauma informed. It was more like a, it was like a mental ward, quite frankly, is where I spent my summer. It was Lehigh Valley Hospital. And all I did was learn tricks of the trade. I learned what I needed to say. I learned how to con therapists. And I picked up a couple new tricks from my roommate who was, you know, pretty much right where I was. So it didn't help. So as soon as I got out of there, right back into to alcohol. Problem was, I was a blackout drunk, which is evident from the first time I picked up. So when I would drink in excess. There was no drinking one. If I drank one, I drank 100, and it never resulted different for me. I couldn't, I even to this day, 10 years of drinking, I can tell you that there was rarely a time that I went out and had a couple drinks. They're just, that concept eluded me. And so I would black out a lot. So I wasn't really the popular girl because I would be vomiting in people's cars and I would end up in not great places. And there were additional assaults as a result of just putting myself in these horrible places. And so I started using drugs. I come from rural Pennsylvania, so drugs and alcohol were not uncommon in junior high. It was just kind of what we did. And so I started smoking pot, doing some pills. That really wasn't great for me. And then someone introduced me to cocaine when I was around 15, 16. And that worked because what it enabled me to do was drink as much as I wanted to drink. But if I used the cocaine, then I didn't black out. So it became this like really bad codependent relationship. And I had a lot of other traumas, and I realized we only have an hour. If we had about five, I could probably tell you all of them. But kept spiraling and spiraling. And
your family still is maintaining this don't ask, don't tell, let's pretend it didn't happen.
Mom's got her own stuff. Yeah. So at this point, the family system is breaking down. Mm-hmm. My oldest brother is getting in trouble. He graduated. He's getting in trouble. My other brother is starting to drink. They're both starting to drink. My oldest brother goes to prison. My parents at 15 separate. My father just said, I can't do it anymore. My mom spent about 2 weeks with us at the house, intoxicated the whole time, and then decided she didn't want to be a mom anymore, and she left. And then my dad came back. And so my dad did the best that he could, but he was the breadwinner. You know, he was the one that had to go out and work, and he was in sales. So that meant a lot of night hours. So we were totally left alone, which was perfect for what we wanted because all we wanted to do was party. So our home became the party house. And, you know, if you've ever seen the show Shameless, we weren't that far of a cry from that. You know, my dad would come home and there was still some structure, but there was no meals. There was no, you know, if I skipped school, it was, you know, my father really didn't have any control over us. And so it was a lot of chaos. And then, like I said, my oldest brother went to prison. My father met another person and they began a relationship, and she was a really good person in my life. So my mom was living in Easton, and after she left, had never once picked me up. And she had her license at this point, had a car, had never once like made me dinner, had never once just called and said, hey, let's go do this. Like there was just no mothering. She went right into friend mode. Mm-hmm. And not a great friend. She was always very verbally abusive with me. Like I said, very competitive. So our relationship was not good, but she was still this drug that I craved because she was my mom and I just wanted to make her happy and I wanted her acceptance. So I would try, you know, I would go get jobs at the places she worked just to be near her. But my life was completely chaotic. And I had lost my best friend to suicide at 15. And so I kept having these layers and layers and layers of trauma. And every layer of trauma that I had to add a bigger layer of intoxicants on top of that. So
right, to keep all of those unexpressed feelings down.
Keep it all pushed down.
Right. The secrets have to be kept hidden.
Absolutely.
So what was the turning point for healing then? I mean, what was the thing that turned the corner
for you? That got me there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had progressed. At age 17, I progressed into crack cocaine. And I was smoking crack on a not a daily basis at this point, but pretty much a couple times a week. My mom got sick with cancer, breast cancer. So she had a mastectomy on one side, and we thought, you know, okay, she's okay. And I kind of, you know, I went to the hospital with her during that, but, you know, like I said, our relationship wasn't super great. And then it came back in 96, and it came back with a vengeance. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty clear that she was really sick. So I avoided her because I couldn't deal with it. I didn't want to see her sick. So I didn't go to appointments with her. I didn't do any of that. And I was a mess, and I was drinking more and using more and more drugs just to cope with just the insanity of it all. And I remember her calling me one day and saying, you know, Jen, my back really hurts. So I was like, all right. Well, I said, I'll come get you. And so I went to her, because at this point I had a car and I was driving. I went and picked her up and took her to the hospital. And admitted her to St. Luke's, and basically they had said, she's not leaving here. You know, it was the end stages of her cancer. But my brothers and I were so lost in our own addictions. At this point, all three of us are out rampant in our addictions. We didn't even realize she was that sick, you know, or it just wasn't on our radar, or wasn't comprehensible. So what I decided to do is I was going to be there for my mom. And my mom was very much in deep denial about being as sick as she was. So she had nothing in order. You know, none of her affairs were in order. So for 2 weeks, I managed to stay sober somehow. And I just ran all around taking care of her affairs during the day, going to the insurance company, you know, going to the bank. I had to change the beneficiary on her insurance because I wanted to make sure that I could afford to bury her before my brothers came for the money, because that's kind of how it was. And so I was doing all this during the day, and then I would be with her at night. And she was at this point on so much morphine that there was no verbal conversations. She did give me power of attorney when she was still kind of cognizant. So she, you know, I was surprised she entrusted me to do that, to take care of her affairs. And then we did have some really loving moments. And then, of course, the whole crazy family comes, you know, all the addicts, the cousins, the aunts, the uncles. It was just chaos at the hospital. And then they all left. And it was just myself and my two cousins in the room. And my mom at this point had not spoken or really done anything for probably 9 days. And I remember it was really dark. And I remember I said to my cousins, I can't take this anymore. And I flipped on the lights and we turned on the television. And as soon as I did that, my mom's eyes opened. So I kind of went to her and I held her, and I was able to hold her and carry her out of this world. And I remember her looking at me, and I remember her seeing me. And, you know, she had been in a coma for 2 weeks, and then she died. And I walked out of that hospital, and I went right into a bar. And I got as intoxicated as I was used to. And then for the 3 months preceding her death, I just spiraled out of control. I was living in a horrible apartment above a bar that I had gotten a job at because it was convenient. I could drink all I wanted. The cook was a Coke dealer, so it was really convenient. And I didn't leave that place for 3 months, and I was just surviving. I wasn't living. And one night it just got to the point where I didn't think that I I was in so much pain. You know, we had talked about the layers. There were so many layers that I often talk about it like a blender. Like there was all this stuff stuffed in the blender, and the lid was coming off.
Right. And the death was like the straw that broke your back, basically.
Yeah. It was the trauma that couldn't fit. Yeah. There wasn't enough drugs and alcohol in the world to conceal the pain that I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And so I thought my only solution was to take my life. I didn't have hope. I didn't have any – there was nothing for me to grasp onto to say, well, maybe – that. No, there was just nothing. So I very brutally attempted to take my own life. And thankfully – by the grace of God, I survived. And at some point, my father had remarried at this point. At some point, I called him, and I left a message on his machine, which still to this day, I can't imagine what it must have been like for them to come home from shopping, you know, on an average Saturday and hear your daughter like that. But he sent my brothers over, and they broke down the door of my apartment, and they found me like half unconscious, laying in a pool of blood. And they saved me, and they took me actually right back to the hospital where my mom had just died. And I woke up the next morning, and you know, people call it a spiritual awakening, a moment of clarity. I don't know what it was. The doctor looked at me and said, "You are very lucky to be alive." And I believed him. And there was something inside of me that began to kind of flicker. And I knew I never had to live that way again. I knew that if I had survived that there was a reason. And so I became really willing. You know, they came in, they did an evaluation, said, you know, I was on the psych ward. Again, that's where they put you.
That's where they go.
That's where you go. And, you know, the doctor said, you don't need our services. You need to go to rehab. You have a drug and alcohol addiction. And I said, you're right. And it was the first time that I acknowledged that the drugs and alcohol were my problem, right? Because they had been my solution for 10 years. They had been my savior. They had protected me. And I became willing. So I went to a rehab called White Deer Run in Allenwood, Pennsylvania, and that place saved my life. One of the first nights that I was there, this young girl came in to share her story, as most people do. And the one thing that she said it's still my mantra today, is that her secrets kept her sick. And I remember sitting there. First of all, I couldn't believe that there was this beautiful girl standing in front of me who basically was telling my story. Like, I thought I was so unique, mm-hmm. and I didn't think other people had gone through what I had gone through. And then when she said her secrets kept her sick, I was like, well, wait a minute, this was the stuff I thought. I thought by keeping it all buried, that protected me. Mm-hmm. And I quickly intuitively learned, and I don't, again, know where this came from either, but I intuitively knew I needed to get every one of those secrets out, and I needed to process through my trauma. Now, I didn't go to a trauma-informed rehab. This was in 1997. The word trauma-informed didn't exist. When they did my intake, there was one question, have you ever been raped? And all that meant was I didn't go in the co-ed facility. I went in the women's facility. You know, men, I guess I can't be around men, whatever that it was supposed to mean. But there was no trauma-informed care. There was no other conversations about the assault. Now, certainly in group, we would talk about things that we had done in our addiction. But I realized very early on that I needed to bring all this stuff out and I needed to unpack my baggage. And so I did that. And I primarily did that via writing. I started to just write and write. And 12-step programs are real big on writing anyway. You know, you do the moral inventory, you look at your wrongs, you kind of bring all that out. And as I started to do that, I became lighter and I felt liberated.
You're listening to Jennifer Storm, and I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX, and I've invited Jennifer into the studio today to tell her story of trauma and addiction to recovery, and now as her role as a victim advocate for the state of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And she's here in town to be the keynote speaker for an event tomorrow night, Wednesday the 24th, being offered by Transitions Mental Health. It's called A Journey of Hope, a community forum on living mentally well. And Jennifer will be speaking from 6 to 8 tomorrow night. And what is the name of New Life Community Church. Thank you very much, Lisa. New Life Community Church in Pismo Beach. There will be resources there. Nonprofit organizations will be there. Agencies will be there offering a resources fair that opens at 5 p.m. Jennifer will then speak. There will also be other speakers coming in to talk about their experiences with addiction and assault and adversity and recovery. And then there will be another hour for opportunities to talk to people during the resource fair portion of the evening. It's a journey of hope. If you want more information, you can contact Transitions Mental Health at 805-540-6500 or go online to t-mha.org. That's Transitions Mental Health. And so, Jennifer, I feel so fortunate to have you here before your big event tomorrow night telling your story. And so in 1996, you finally...
97.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The light comes on, and it sounds like it's a lot of... And I love the term that you use, that you unpacked your baggage, because when I talk about doing therapy with my clients, I always talk about that we all carry baggage in our lives, that a life lived in any way has baggage.
Absolutely.
And that the role of therapy in our lives is to provide us with a safe space to open up all of those bags and to have someone witness us as we sort through all of the things we've stuffed away in our lives. Mm-hmm. And then if you do the work well, you get to repack the bags, because you never throw the bags away. Mm-hmm. The story is the story.
Absolutely.
But you repack those bags, suck the air out of them, flatten them out, and then repack, lighten that load so you can go out and continue living your life. Mm-hmm. And so where did this take you after recovery? What was your journey from that point?
I had kind of worn out my welcome in the Lehigh Valley area. And even though I probably could have gone and lived with my father and my stepmother, who was an amazing, loving, wonderful mother to me, even though she had never had children herself, she kind of inherited this mess and really made the best of it. I knew and I learned that people, places, and things, right, avoid those. And so I didn't want to go home because it just didn't feel like home anymore. It felt like just darkness.
The old story.
Like every street corner had a story and they mm-hmm. weren't good. So I followed the suggestions of rehab. I completed the 30 days and then I went to a halfway house in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I lived there for about 2 months. And that was a little bit more chaotic. Like rehab for me was like this experience, you know, where I was just unearthing and uncovering. And then I went to the halfway house and it was a little bit different. It was different people. Not everyone there was really trying to be sober. And so that was a struggle. You know, there were people that were still using in their rooms and then getting thrown out. And it was just a little bit more chaotic. So I stayed for about 2 months. And then I decided I needed to go somewhere else. So I had done the one thing you're not supposed to do in rehab, and I got into a relationship.
Okay.
Because I still at that point did not realize that, you know, sex and love, those were other things that we used to escape. So it was just somebody said, hey, I like you. And I was like, yes, I'm worthy. So, of course, I ran into the arms of this guy. And what it did for me is it got me to State College, Pennsylvania, which is home to the Pennsylvania State University. So I moved there, and I lived in a room in his house with his dad for about a month. And I quickly realized, like, this relationship's going nowhere. I don't even know who I am, let alone, like, how am I going to be with somebody else? So I got a sponsor, as I was going to 12-step meetings at this time. And my sponsor said, hey, why don't you, you know, move in with me and you can live with me. So I moved in with her for a little bit, got a job. Was going to meetings. I was probably going to two meetings a day. I didn't do a 90-90. I did like a 180 and 180 because I didn't have anything else to do. And I was loving what I was finding in recovery, and it was giving me structure and stability. And these were things that I hadn't had. And then I started going to therapy because for whatever reason, intuitively, I just knew I need to deal with this stuff. And the rooms, the 12-step rooms, were not a safe place for me to talk about those things, nor is it really an appropriate place to talk about those things. You know, there's a time and a place, and it wasn't there. I discovered that my sponsor wasn't super sober. She was smoking pot. And so then I called my parents. I was like, yeah, I got to get out of here. And so I had a little bit of money left over from my mom, from her insurance. And so it was enough to get me this little one-bedroom apartment in State College. And I learned to live. I learned to live by myself, and I learned independence, and I started to really get to know myself. And so I spent about a year and a half doing that. And one day in therapy, I remember my therapist looking at me and saying, why don't you go to college? And I remember laughing because I barely graduated high school. I had a 1.5 GPA, and I did not take the SATs.
And I don't even know if a 1.5 really counts, but
I barely showed up. So I laughed at her. I was like, no, I'm not going to be able to go to Penn State. And Penn State, if you're from Pennsylvania, was like the holy grail of colleges. I mean, I watched my friends who were super smart, did really well on the SATs, not get into Penn State. So, but she said, no, there's this Office of Vocational Rehabilitation. And they can, you know, work with you. And now that you're a resident here, the university takes a certain amount of residents, and they can take you on a provisional status. And I was like, oh, there's no way. So I talked to OVR, which is the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, and I applied. And it was the first time I had told my story outside of, you know, the safety of my therapist's office or a 12-step meeting. And I wrote it in my essay. Just said, this is who I am. And then lo and behold, I got in. And so I became a freshman, and I was an older returning
adult. As a freshman,
at
what age?
I was 22, 23 at this point. Yeah, 1999. So I was 22, almost 23. But I loved it, and I became like this sponge. You know, for 10 years, I was anesthetized. I had no idea what was going on in the world. I didn't know anything, really. And so I became just this thirsty for knowledge, kind of like the little girl that I was, that straight-A student. I kind of woke her up. So I fell in love with college. And I was still carrying one other secret that I knew was there. I had known it was there since kindergarten, but didn't know how to bring it out. And that's that I was gay. And so that started to really haunt me. And it was that one piece of luggage that was just kind of clinking around inside mm-hmm. of me. And I was like, yeah, I gotta get this out. And so I didn't just come quietly out of the closet like some people do. I came flying out of the closet into like this life of activism on campus at Penn State. I went through this radical transformation. Prior to that, you know, I had been everything. I had been the hippie. I had been the druggie. I had been the prep. You know, you name the stereotypical kid, and I was it at some point, right? I went through all those trends. And they were just these masks I was putting on myself because I didn't know who I was. So when I came out, I thought, I need to get rid of all this because I really need to understand who I am. So I shaved my head. I stopped wearing makeup. And I just started wearing like just kind of just baggy, really nondescript clothes. And I remember when the night I shaved my head, I remember looking at myself in the mirror and I remember going, oh, like I'm really beautiful. And I remember seeing my eyes for the first time. And I remember seeing a light in them that I hadn't ever seen before. And so it was a very cool process for me. And I think I needed to strip myself down so bare so that I could start to learn who I was, like what I like, what are my interests. Turns out I'm a very girly girl. I love makeup. I love hair. I love all that. But I had to like do all that to learn that. And so I was really active on the college campus. And if you know anything about Penn State in the 2000s, there was a lot of racial discrimination. There was a lot of hate crimes. And so I became a victim of a hate crime. So here I am, a couple years in sobriety, very active on campus. Like I was, you know, protesting and doing rallies and in the paper all the time. And I am the recipient of these death threats. And I was going to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor because I thought I want to give back what I've been given. And then I got this letter from a victim advocate. And I said, well, what the heck is this? You know, I didn't know what that was. And so then I started to educate myself about the criminal and juvenile justice system. And I started to realize that there's like this whole system of advocates that help people. And the minute I learned that, I thought, this is it. This is my path.
The thing that had been missing for you when you were 12 years old.
Yes.
It found its way back to you. And it's interesting that it took another assault of some mm-hmm. kind in your life for you to make contact mm-hmm. with these services.
Yes.
And how long had the Victim Advocate Program been around?
Oh, gosh. They'd definitely been on campus the entire time I was there. And I'm mm-hmm. sure they had been there for probably since the early 90s. They were a campus-based agency. So, yeah, they had probably been there for at least a decade.
So you got involved with the program, one, getting services. And then how did you get involved? Because you must have graduated.
Yes. So this happened right as I was graduating. Okay. So I didn't so much engage their services a ton, with the exception of like getting notifications and understanding what was happening. But then I moved to Harrisburg and I accepted a job to advocate and lobby for hate crime legislation. So what had happened was my offender was from New Jersey and he was a juvenile. And in New Jersey, they charged him with 7 counts, and one of those counts was a hate crime. But what I learned is if he had been in Pennsylvania, he wouldn't have gotten charged with a hate crime because sexual orientation wasn't covered. So that pissed me off. And I thought, well, I'm going to change that, because that was kind of my attitude at that time. So I went to Harrisburg. I lobbied. I got involved with the statewide Pennsylvania Rights Coalition, and we did. We changed the law. As I was working with that organization and kind of doing lobbying and education, I started meeting all these survivors that were kind of approaching me. And the agency I was working for at the time didn't offer those services. But I started to find myself really wanting to. I wanted to help people. And so I saw an ad in the paper for an executive director of a victim witness assistance program. And at this point, I had started my master's in organizational management because I was working at a nonprofit and I was a managing director. And I thought, I'm going to apply for this job, which, you know, is kind of a ballsy move. Yeah. I was 28 years
old. Gotta be bold.
Yeah. And so I applied. I applied for the job. And, you know, there were 100 and some candidates. And I remember I did my research. But what I did in the interview was I was brutally honest. And not only did I share my own story, but I did enough research on the agency that I knew that there were so many ways that they could be improved. Mm-hmm. And I only knew that really as a consumer. Mm-hmm. And so I remember that my final interview, the one judge, because there was a judge, and she said, you know, you kind of insulted us in the interview. But it's what we need to hear, because what you're saying is what we're missing. And so my final interview was with the district attorney. And I remember going into his office and I was very nervous. And he had this piece of paper in front of him and he kind of slid it across the table. And I opened it and it was my juvenile record, which I didn't even remember I had. And I was like, oh, this isn't going to go well. And so he said, you know, it was for underage drinking. I had gotten arrested. I was on probation. And he said, listen, you just got caught where most of us did it anyway. And he said, I'm gonna look past this. I'm gonna offer you this job. And I couldn't believe that here was this Republican district attorney taking a chance on me. And I was this 28-year-old girl who had only had a couple years of recovery and was brutally honest about it. And so I'm forever grateful to that man. His name is Edward Marsico. I'm forever grateful for him because he looked past the stigma of addiction, which we know exists, and he took a chance on me. My first client in that job was a 12-year-old rape victim. And I was 28, so I'm the age of my offender. And I remember working with her, and I remember for the first time seeing how young 12 was. Because I was still carrying some guilt. You know, you think you're so much older than you are. And as rape survivors, we unfortunately own way too much of our own crime. And that little girl took that away from me. And then I also knew, and of course I never told her that because it wouldn't have been ethical to do that. I was there for her. She, you know, what I got from her was what I kept. But I remember thinking, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. Like, this is my passion. So I spent 10 and a half years at that program. And I worked with all victims from theft to homicide. I did a lot of death notification, a lot of first response to homicides. Worked with domestic violence. We had a protection from abuse clinic. And, you know, just fell in love with victim services. And I continued my statewide work. You know, I still liked lobbying and legislation and policy. And so I always stayed connected to the statewide piece of it. And when the job of victim advocate came open, the governor at the time, Governor Corbett, appointed me. And I had to go through like a Senate confirmation. And I remember in the press release, in my appointment, he had spoken about how I was a recovering addict and a survivor. And I thought, like, am I dreaming? Like, in what? And again, this is another Republican man who is acknowledging that I am a recovering alcoholic and drug addict and appointing me to this huge position. I mean, I often joke, like, I went from being a crackhead to the appointed victim advocate of the Commonwealth. Like, how does that happen? But it happened because people took chances on me and people believed in me. And without that, I wouldn't be here.
My guest is Jennifer Storm. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And I wish we had hours to have this conversation because there's so many places I would like to go. There's so many things that you've talked about. One, having the right person at the right time mm-hmm. pop up in your life. A little bit of, you know, destiny that mm-hmm. happened to help you along the way. Your own inner strength and resilience. Having a partial recovery of your relationship with your mom. Like, these things all kind of fell into place. Mm-hmm. And so how long have you been serving your where are you in your 6-year appointment?
I'm 4 years in. You're so 4 years, I have 2 more years. Mm-hmm.
And so what does your life look like today, 4 years into this appointment, 20 years sober? Congratulations.
Just celebrate that in November.
What does your life look like today?
Full. It's just so full. I am the happiest I've ever been. I have 2 children. So I'm married. My wife and I met. I was on vacation in Aruba 8 years ago in February. And I was there with a friend of mine, and she had known a lot of the locals because she had vacationed on Aruba a lot. And one of her friends was supposed to meet us on the pier. It was this pier, Boogaloo Pier. If you ever go to Aruba, it's beautiful. And she walked onto the pier, and I remember looking at her and just fell in love. Like, literally love at first sight. I was so captivated by her. And to this day, my wife has this joy and this spirit that is just – it's illuminating. I call her my magical unicorn. And so she and I did long distance for a couple years. And then eventually this job was kind of percolating because I was looking at places in Aruba and I thought, well, maybe I'll move to Aruba. Like, who doesn't want to live on an island? Mm-hmm. But then this job was kind of coming to fruition and I knew I wanted this job. So she had agreed to move here. And so we got married and we became foster parents. And so now we have a 19-year-old and we have a 2.5-year-old. And we're no longer – I mean, we're still open an open foster home, but with both of our children, we've adopted the 2.5-year-old and we have legal custody of the teenager. So it's a full life. It's a beautiful life.
And how – I guess when you do programs like this, you know, the event you're going to do tomorrow night at the Journey of Hope, what is it you want people to take away from their – conversation with you or their experience of you?
Hope. I want people to know that no matter how far down you've been or how dark it gets, that there's always an opportunity. There is always a chance for light. And there's one way to go, right? When you get that far down, there's one way to go. You go up it. I just want people to know that that transformation can happen at any point and to never give up. To never give up on themselves, to never give up on their loved ones, which is hard. And we could have spent an hour talking about what it's like to live and love a person with an addiction.
Which is, I guess you'll have to come back because there is all of your extended family story that we also would dive into, because all of that impacts and having to make choices of how much we'll engage and how much we'll be separate. And it's interesting you said how to love those that have addictions or aren't living well. It's one of my themes of the show is it's easy to love people when they're on their best behavior. Mm-hmm. Our real challenge in life is how do we find love and support for those when they're not in their best place, and to retain some kind of relationship, but not lose yourself in it.
Absolutely.
And the other piece too is the idea that you it sounds like
And then everything was great, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I told this whole story, and with 5 minutes to go, everything is just perfect. But I imagine that you continue to hit rough spots.
Oh, yeah.
And so what is it that keeps you strong now when you hit these life dips or traumas or adversities?
I think it's first I have a very strong foundation in recovery. So I know I learned who I am. Mm-hmm. And I think my self-awareness is my greatest asset, because I know if I'm feeling a little funky, I can feel it. I know when I'm off balance now. I'm a very structured person. And then I have all these tools that I have kind of gathered over the years that I know which ones will work. And, you know, I might need to try four or five before the sixth one actually does what I need. But it's building those tools and having that arsenal of support that I know that I need. You know, it takes a lot. I often say to my wife, God love you, because it takes a lot for me to, you know, get through sometimes weeks and months. And it's, you know, going to 12-step meetings. It is meditating. Meditation is hugely instrumental in my life. Working out, you know, knowing when I need to exercise and have that physical release. Not being afraid of emotions and feeling what I need to feel. And just living my life as honestly as I can.
One of the other things that you mentioned and struck me is that there also isn't just one road to recovery. Mm. That when we're struggling, when people are going through dark, tough times, it may take a while to end up in the right place. That you went to different recoveries or rehabs and you went into a halfway house and that wasn't right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there takes some inner strength and resilience to realize if a place isn't bringing you healing, it's not the right place. And that we sometimes just blindly trust anything that sounds like it's a professional organization or the person has answer, that we still can't just hand ourselves over.
Yeah. Oh, and at one point in my recovery, I left 12-step rooms for a couple years, actually about 7 years. This is a whole other story, but I lost all three of my sponsors. I had three sponsors in recovery, and all three of them died in some way. But the last one was like my best friend, my soulmate. I mean, she was my sister. And I got mad. And when I would go to meetings, people would say, well, why don't you have another sponsor? And where have you been? And I got angry at the 12-step program. And I write about that actually for The Fix. And so I left for a while. And that's when I found meditation. And then I found a program called Refuge Recovery. And there's multiple paths. And I think when you are a person living in long-term recovery, you're going to need different tools at different times. And not everything is going to work all the time. And so, you know, it was good for me to explore other things and other healing aspects. You know, I've done grief yoga and I love it. I mean, there's just other things that help me process, music, writing. It's all of that.
So I know that this is just the beginning of so many stories. I hate having to wrap it up, but my guest today has been Jennifer Storm. She's an author, appointed victim advocate. She has written three books, and you can get her books by visiting
anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local library. My website is jenniferstorm.com.
And if you'd like to hear more of Jennifer's story, please join us tomorrow night at the Journey of Hope in Pismo Beach at the New Life Community Church. You can find out information about this yearly event. It's the ninth year that Transitions Mental Health has been offering this program, A Journey of Help. There'll be other people speaking about their stories of trauma and recovery. There'll be agencies there offering resources for the community. It's a free event for anyone to attend from 6 to 8. You don't even have to RSVP, but if you'd like more information, contact 540-6500. That's Transitions Mental Health. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can also find me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Visit us on my Facebook page. You can send me a message. But as always, I appreciate you supporting Public Radio KCBX.